right. Good afternoon, everybody. For those of you who weren't here this morning, I'm Ethan Bellamy. I cover MLPs for Baird. Thank you for being here today. This panel was my idea. I asked Nicholas if we could have some of the people that I read all the time get up here and give us the view from the Fourth Estate, which I think is pretty salient given what's coming out of the White House right now. So this ought to be interesting. And hopefully I'll ask them some questions where they say no comment, which will be the ultimate irony. What we're going to do is I'm going to let them, these three reporters from different segments of the press, tell you a little bit about where they're from, what they do, how they cover energy, and then we'll dive into some questions after that. So, Amy, why don't you get us started, please?
Yeah, sure. Hi, everybody. My name's Amy Stone. I'm a reporter at Barron's, and I write the current yield column as well as the income investing blog. So, basically, I cover anything that pays out current income, so MLPs fit in very nicely there. I also cover bonds, REITs, dividend stocks, a whole bunch of things. So I think I differ from you guys a little bit in that I have a pretty broad range of things I'm covering.
Great. I'm Ernie Scheider with Reuters. I write about mostly E&P, but sometimes that involves downstream and midstream. The past year, it's been a lot of DAPL stuff, a lot of Trump stuff. I was based in North Dakota for about 19 months, so sort of lived the shale boom and bust and come from that unique perch. So that's kind of my main beat.
Paul Hart, I'm editor-in-chief for Midstream Business Magazine. Ethan, it is comforting to know you actually read the publication. Sometimes I picture its highest and best uses leveling wobbly tables. We, as the name implies, are focused on the middle link of the energy value chain, gathering, processing, transportation, and storage, and we also reach out and include LNG somewhat because I like to view LNG as sort of the ultimate gas processing. But that's the universe that we focus on. We do lap, of course, over to the upstream side, what's happening with E&P, and also lap down into refining and marketing since we're the conduit between the two ends of the business.
All right. So we've got some pretty different approaches to reporting here. I think I just want to start off by maybe can you talk about a story that you covered recently and how you or your publication approached it? Maybe, Paul, when we were prepping for this, Paul said, there's a different way to deal with the trade press than with the generalist press. And maybe if you could start there, Paul, that'd be helpful.
I think that's an important point I like to make to folks because people who are not in the media, I think, tend to view it as a monolith, much in the same way that people who are not in the energy business view energy as a monolith. And that's something that I think is key I try to make that point that we have a different perspective on the business than, say, the mainstream media does. Hopefully we are more cognizant of the issues that the industry faces. I'm kind of a unique critter because I've been on both sides of the fence. I've been in corporate communications as well as the press, and I like to keep some anecdotes from my days in corporate communications. One of my favorites was the reporter with a major newspaper who called me one time, and my employer was repurposing a pipeline from gas to crude, and so I'm going through the banter of so many thousand barrels per day and is going to be in the terminal, is going to have so many thousand barrels a day. And I paused and with his best gotcha voice said, "And what do you do with the empty barrels?" And I know he had, Pulitzer Prize. I finally caught them. There is this weedy lot in Kansas full of rusting steel drums. And, of course, kind of depressurized and said, you know, a barrel is a unit of measure, like a quart or a liter. I think I'm a little more aware of how things work than that. So I think it's important if you're in a management role to view the media differently by their role. And our purpose here is to cover what the industry is doing. We're not there to gotcha. We're trying to get some long-term trends. It's the nature of a magazine to try to look ahead, get the binoculars out, and see what's up ahead, much more so than who's, you know, dating Kim Kardashian this week.
It's not me.
Not me.
But, Ernie, you would like to win a Pulitzer, so wouldn't we all? Your approach is different here.
I might push back just gently on Paul and say that, you know, the internet has definitely changed the approach to media. And so whereas 25 years ago, if somebody from Reuters and somebody from, you know, a trade press publication were on the same panel, you know, I would agree with you. But I think now, especially as investors out in the audience, you know, you've got to know that you've got to know that the person you're talking to, the reporter, is somebody you trust. And I think that goes back to before.
Absolutely.
You know, there have always been good reporters. There have always been reporters that think there are physical barrels rusting in Kansas. I mean, especially a Reuters perspective, you know, people think of Reuters as, you know, the old wire service, the old wire engine. I compete all the time with the Journal, and I beat the Journal a lot. So that's my perspective.
Got it. And Amy?
Okay. Well, I was thinking about your question about a story that I'd done recently, and, you know, I think it's pretty illustrative of the Barron's approach, but the last time I did a column about MLPs was right on the one-year anniversary of the lows of last February, so it was kind of taking a look very broadly at the sector and what had happened since then. You know, there'd been this massive run-up in the stocks, and then the question is, are investors too late to get in? So I talked to a lot of experts. I mean, I talked to a lot of money managers, mainly portfolio managers, investment managers, about what they saw and looked at different valuation measures. And my conclusion was that it actually looked like a pretty good opportunity seen across the entire spectrum of everything I cover. With 7% yields, that's quite attractive, with the Trump administration providing a positive backdrop, energy prices stabilizing, OPEC, the OPEC agreement appearing to hold. So it was pretty positive. And then I did raise all the risks. Like, of course, remember, these are energy investments. If energy prices fall, you know, you're subject to a lot of risk. And, you know, capital markets staying open are really key for this sector. So that just gives you an example of how, you know, I approach it for the magazine.
Got it. Okay. Well, since we have a former North Dakota resident here, I want to get to the big and the meatiest news story, which is the Dakota Access Pipeline. Energy Transfer Partners is actually here. But Nicholas agreed with me that not putting them on the agenda and sparing everyone in this room from a bunch of protesters marching in here would probably be a good idea. So, unfortunately, that hasn't happened yet. If there is anybody here to protest, bring it on. I'm up here.
We'd like to talk to you.
Yeah, they'll pull out cameras and take pictures, I'm sure. My question on Dakota Access, and I've been immersed in this from day one, and we do follow Energy Transfer Partners and the other members of the family, is, you know, how have you thought about this from the perspective of covering such a binary, heated issue? And in particular, it seems to have been a sort of a seminal moment for social media versus, you know, traditional press. Maybe that's just because I have followed it so intently, and it's just popped up on my radar. But I'm just curious what you think about you know, what's going to be the legacy of Dakota Access, and how is it going to impact this group going forward?
Yeah, I mean, my biggest takeaway from Dakota Access.
Could you get just a little closer
sure.
to the mic? Yeah.
My biggest takeaway for Dakota Access, especially as it affects the investing space, is this is probably the first time that we've seen such a huge impact on the energy space by environmentalists, and their success in really combining with two or three other potent forces, native rights, environmental issues, and concerns about energy transportation. And so you see this perfect confluence really coming together there. And so I think that's going to be the legacy here. They delayed this pipeline by, almost a year? Hundreds of millions of dollars wasted by ETP. We've got, they failed, but, because the pipeline's going to be in operation in, two or three weeks, I think? But I think it's a harbinger of what's to come. And I think if you're an investor in a pipeline or any energy project, you've got to expect and factor that into your costs now. And I think in the past, it was given a short riff by Wall Street. We've still got people there protesting, the reservation is huge, and the reservation it does still obviously abut the pipeline. And I just saw today there is a PayPal account where you can donate money to people who still camped out there. They might be kicked off the Army Corps land, but they're still there. And so there's going to be issues that continue. There's a pipeline in Florida. There's pipelines in Montana that are getting opposition. This will continue to be a big issue for a while, and I don't think Wall Street is factoring in the potential cost of delays moving forward. And Donald Trump will only be president for another 3.5, maybe 7.5 years. So, depending on who comes in after him, depending on the administration, depending on courts, this is not going away. To your point about social media, social media definitely helped galvanize the movement. Shailene Woodley is a famous actress who, basically helped spark this last summer and got it out there. She's been joined by other celebrities. But I do think while social media has been a very powerful force, especially through Facebook Live and other mediums, the value of shoe leather reporting, like what we do every day, is extremely important. There's that old adage, never trust a reporter with clean shoes. And I think that's especially true. I have very dirty shoes, as you'll find out when I'm done. But I think that's especially true. As I said, I used to live in North Dakota when Dapple blew up. I went up there again many times. Camped out in my car during a blizzard. I think those are things that you can't discount if you as an investor want to know what's going on the ground and what matters there and how it affects your portfolio. So long-winded answer, but that's sort of my main take.
Paul?
I think he's right, and some comments here that social media has changed everything, and to his credit, I think our new president has figured that out more than most.
In a huge way.
And he is scoring major points, whether you agree with him or not. Dakota Access was definitely a case in point of what you can do with social media. And this is something that I think management of energy firms needs to become more aware of. My perception is, people who run energy companies, by their nature, are engineers, lawyers, and accountants, and they tend to be very logical. And if you go out and you're doing a town hall meeting and you've got a PowerPoint and you're showing them, you only have so many incidents per million hours of running a pipeline and see how safe it is, that still doesn't address the emotion of what if the thing blows up in my backyard and kills my kid.
Right.
And I had an editorial in one of our recent issues where I said the industry needs to learn to be more emotional because you're working with an emotional topic here. You're not working with a logical topic. Obviously, pipeline is safer than trucking. Obviously, pipeline safer than rail.
Most people don't know that, though.
But most people don't know that.
Right.
And it's hard, I think, for the media, including my compatriots here, to convey that because much of the public does not read what we do. They do consume Facebook. They do consume Twitter. I'm on Facebook, and I'm just appalled at some of the stuff that pops up. They're like, where did they get that? But it is in the arena of ideas, and I think the industry needs to have a greater presence there. This is something new, and new in the sense that it's only been around a dozen years or so. And it's even more than, you know, doing a website or whatever. So it's something that they need to work into. How are we going to communicate with our constituent publics? And that can include not only investors, but community leaders, property owners, whoever they may be, because there's more and more a default to, I go to Facebook or I go to Twitter to find out what's going on.
I would just sort of add on DePaul real quick on the emotional side. Consumers are emotional people. Humans are emotional people. And I think to your point about engineers, you know, engineers look at ones and zeros. And with Dakota Access, that cost them a lot of money and a lot of time. So the original route for Dakota Access was going to go north of the city of Bismarck, which is predominantly white, predominantly Caucasian. And from an engineer's perspective, that just didn't work because you'd have to get a lot of right-of-ways, you'd have to do a lot of other things. Excuse me, that way did work. What didn't work was sort of going south. But then the Bismarck Water Department got involved and said, well, we don't want this here. So then engineers said, okay, well, we'll just move it south. And they didn't really think that there's a giant Indian reservation right there that might not like a giant pipeline going right next door, even though the pipeline did not technically touch the reservation. But from a logical perspective, the engineer just thought on ones and zeros and didn't fully conceptualize the fact that this could be a big issue. And nobody at the company thought this could be a big issue. Well, to my knowledge, nobody thought that. So I think, to Paul's point, the emotion and sort of looking beyond what looks good on a map or what doesn't look good on a map could have helped the situation here.
Again, back to the emotion point, that Northern Border Pipeline had been there for 35 years, and nobody said anything.
Yeah, and I wanted to make an additional point, which is, to some extent, the protests are moving out of the Dakotas and into big cities, so I think they're going to continue. And one thing I saw just in recent weeks that I think that people in this room should really be aware of is the pressure to divest of pipeline companies that is starting to percolate. There's a lot of pressure being put on the financial institutions that, I shouldn't say a lot, I should say it's just starting to percolate, but we saw Seattle, halt business with Wells Fargo maybe temporarily, and some other institutional investors have said that they didn't want to own banks. So that's something to watch. It might be sort of the next leg of the
closure, hashtag closure account.
Yeah. Just wait.
All right. I think I'll pause there and see if there are any questions from the audience. Yes, ma'am? There's a mic. Yeah.
Let me say I'm a conspiracy theorist. Okay.
Awesome.
We're all part of the Illuminati.
I'm ready.
How much of what's going on with all of this protesting do you think has been promoted?
I objectively don't think there's a giant hand moving this, a puppet master. I do think that when you have a confluence of a perfect storm, so to speak, of issues that people really care about and have been caring about for a while, and there's this, American Indian tribe there, how can we help them out and sort of reinforce them? I think that's what you're seeing. I did not encounter any paid protesters, and I spent a lot of time walking around that camp. Were there people there that there was a cause they really, really believed in, and maybe somebody bought them a plane ticket there? Yes. But were they being paid a stipend of, $200 a day to sit there and hold a sign? No.
I haven't done that kind of reporting on the ground, but that's definitely my impression.
I do, completely. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of money funneled into helping the people up there, but they're legitimate. I would say that they're legitimate concerns and grievances. I mean, I may not agree with them, but I don't think that it was just somebody getting bought to go up there.
I mean, it really was the next coming of Occupy Wall Street, and this was reinforced to me. There was one night at the beginning of December, a giant blizzard came in, and I was stuck at the camp in my car. And my boss back in New York is freaking out. He's like, you got to find warm food. I was like, where the hell do you think I'm going to find warm food? But I did, actually. And there was I'm pleased to report, one of the best meals I had in a long time was at this protest camp. and I'm waiting in line, and there's a guy behind me who just arrived, I don't know from where, but he was on the phone talking to somebody, and he said, buddy, you got to get down here. This is an awesome place. You know, I found a free tent. You know, somebody gave me a free sleeping bag. You know, it's just awesome. I'm lying for free food right now. It's just awesome. And if I had turned around and asked him what Standing Rock was, he wouldn't have known.
Yeah, I think my perception is this is a valid issue. People want to know. If you've never had anything to do with a pipeline before, you have some valid questions about it. And I go back to the anecdote. Heart Energy does our Marcellus Utica Midstream Conference in Pittsburgh every January, and I was talking to a gentleman in the business. And he said it was really interesting, particularly in the early days of the Marcellus, that you'd go out in rural Pennsylvania and said somebody brings in some bulldozers and they start knocking over trees and they're leveling out a space on the hillside and there's something going on, and you put up a head frame for a coal mine, nothing. Not a word is said. But if you bring in the bulldozers, level out a pad, and set up a drilling rig, every phone at the courthouse lights up. Who are these guys? What's going on? And in the same way in West Texas, nobody thinks about a drilling rig, but if you put up a head frame out in Loving County, Texas, you'd probably get some phone calls. So it's all in what you're used to. My good friend Russell Gold, that did the book The Boom about the shale revolution, really touched on that because his family has property in Pennsylvania, and even though he's very aware of the energy business, he's chief energy writer for the Wall Street Journal, he really had a feel, I think, for what the locals were facing there with the development in the industry. So there is some valid interest in what's going on. It's a valid issue. There may be some money going into promoting it, but the industry needs to address it somehow.
Ernie, was that hot meal you had made over wood, or do they use a propane stove for that?
Propane.
This is one of my great observations, and back to my corporate communications days, the company I was working for at the 10 was... had some permits with the California Coastal Commission, and we had been going to these hearings, and they were having die-ins in the hotel lobby and, you know, throwing oil all over the lobby, which Holiday Inn did not care for. But it intrigued me that if you went through the parking garage, they're all full of Suburbans. I don't recall seeing anybody walking there. I don't see anybody recall riding a bicycle there. Maybe they took the bus. I don't know. But, you know, there's not the cause and effect connection between what these people are doing to create a product enables me to enjoy the lifestyle I have. And that's kind of an emotional thing that maybe we need to work on.
Any other questions from the audience? Yes, sir.
So it sounds like we need to engineer a few trucks carrying lots of oil. One of them tips over and spills into the river. Another one catches on fire right next to the camp. A few of these, and maybe that'll change the attitude.
That might not be good for your industry's image.
Yeah. I don't recommend that.
I think the problem with that is you know, then they're going to say, well, let's just do away with it entirely. Let's build more windmills. And unless there is some big breakthrough in the technology soon, we cannot build enough windmills and enough solar panels to sustain our economy. And if you ever drive out Interstate 10 across West Texas, you go past mile after mile after mile of those things spinning around in the wind, you realize they're providing like 1 or 2% of the electricity Texas uses. What would it take to sustain a Dallas and a Houston with windmills? So again, people aren't making the
connection. So let me let's get back on track to a big picture topic, which is the energy policy change in D.C. Under Trump. Could you talk about how your organization is approaching this as one part of a, I guess, a smaller change? And you know, this is kind of intertwined, you know, with DAPL and whatnot. But you know, just very big picture, how do you see the D.C. policy shift impacting your reporting?
Okay, I'll jump in here. I think you know, I'm speaking for myself personally rather than Barron's as a whole, because all our writers are pretty independent and, you know, provide their own analysis. But right now, I just think there's tremendous uncertainty about what's actually going to appear in terms of bills and the legislative process, and also when. So that goes for, you know, tax policy as well as energy policy. Obviously, the Trump administration wants to increase U.S. production, which I think led to some gains last fall. But now the question is, will the demand materialize? Are we going to see the economy, global economy, keep growing to the point where we need a lot more volume of crude? We've seen natural gas prices plummet, so that's been a little bit of a headwind lately for MLPs. So I think one point I really wanted to raise here is all the confusion about tax policy. Because so many of our Barron's readers who own MLPs own them for the tax benefits. They might have originally bought them because they thought it was a really stable sort of toll-taking model that was going to provide income and not be too volatile. If they're still in them, they've learned that's not really the case. But if they're still in them, they're still there for the tax benefits. They don't want to sell. They might have huge capital gains built up. So, you know, I think it's unclear how they're going to be affected by the tax policy, but for people who communicate with investors who are in the room, I think to the extent that you can make that clear as these proposals, you know, get inked, that would be a huge help.
Thanks, Amy.
So at Reuters, we have these things called the trust principles. They're basically like our Ten Commandments, and one of those the big ones is freedom from bias. And right after Trump was elected, our editor-in-chief, Steve Adler, put out a memo basically covering Trump the Reuters way. And basically all that, if you boil it down to one sentence, it means we're going to cover the White House like we've always covered the White House. And that means fairly impartially doing sort of that shoe leather reporting that we all do every day. And I mean, I think you as readers and people in the broader world expect that and appreciate that. And that means we're not going to do anything to sort of curry favor, but we're also not going to sort of become, you know, overly zealous on the other side. You know, that's sort of 10,000-foot view sort of on my level that that boils down to, okay, what does energy tax policy or energy policy changes in general mean for subscribers? We have a big focus on the buy side now, so how does what Trump does, what his administration does sort of affect you and your peers? So that's, you know, and that requires, you know, a lot of homework, that requires a lot of digging, but I think that's, at the end of the day, why journalism is so essential and what we do is so important. We're not just scribes. We are people that actually digest, think through, and inform the world basically about what's going on. I don't think that changes under Trump, and I don't think it will change after Trump.
Interesting times in Washington. One of the things we carry in the magazine that I find very informative is we are doing a column by Matt Height, who is the Vice President of Government Relations for GPA Midstream. And Matt's a really sharp guy. He's a former Senate staffer and knows the Hill pretty well. And he has some good insights, not only on what the administration is doing on tax policy, but regulatory affairs. He's got a good one on some of the new PHMSA regulations that's coming out in our next issue. I wish we could do more. The problem with the trade press is, you know, the industry sneezes and we catch cold, and I'm, from a personal standpoint, looking at going into a more predictable industry like oil field services. So we really don't have the ability to do some of the things I would like right now from a staff point otherwise.
Thanks. I still have one question. I think we'll wrap up after this.
General question. Now, if you look at the news. Of course, you know, this is not specifically for a particular industry. The generation and dissemination of the news is pretty much similar, but the consumption has changed quite a bit. You know, very few people read newspapers, network news are gone, social media, Facebook. Where do you see this thing going, really, to make strong public opinion? You know, a lot of times now, people get the information from the street. So, you know, in the old days, we used to have, I don't know, when I was younger, I used to watch Cronkite. He used to say, this is the way it is. Now, there's nothing like that. The trust factor is gone, and it's very difficult to gain trust when nobody really paying attention to you. The so-called fake news, you know, some of them are paid. It depends on whatever advantage you want to take. So what's the role of the press from your perspective to make this a little bit better?
I think we continue to do what we have, and I know our respective organizations, you know, have high standards of high standards for ourselves, and I think that's what we can continue to do. I think to your point about Walter Cronkite, yes, there was a time when, you know, he was sort of right up there with God and what he said, but obviously those times have changed, and I think it requires an informed populace now more than ever. You know, democracy requires, you know, an informed you know, country. And so I think everyone's got to take responsibility. I mean, not to browbeat, but I think it's extremely important. So, you know, because your second cousin twice removed says on Facebook that, you know, Barack Obama was born in Kenya, you know, doesn't mean that it's true. But people that believe that, you know, I think we as a society need to get better at encouraging them to look at a plethora of sources. I'm not a teacher, but, you know, if I taught third grade, I'd be, you know, giving, you know, my students a lot of newspapers, a lot of different news sources every single day to sort of, you know, teach them sort of that logic behind it. I think that's the best way, you know, and that's, you know, it's perhaps not a direct answer to your question, but I think, you know, an informed, diverse populace is the best thing for the U.S. and the world, really.
Are ill-informed, they rule the society. So, you know, until something else better comes up.
Well, the three of us are doing our jobs, so we're putting it out there.
I think we'll wrap things up there. Thank you, panelists. I really appreciate your time. Thank you.